Hey, hey, what's up? What's up? How you doing? Open neck, open neck. How you doing, Mr. Who?
I'm doing pretty good. How you doing?
I'm doing really good, man.
Excellent, excellent.
It's good to be back here with you again.
It is.
For the open neck show. This week we are talking about
Jean-Michel Basquiat.
Jean-Michel Basquiat. Yes, the famous painter, although there are some people out there that don't know much about Jean-Michel.
You don't. So we'll give a little background before we get started.
Yeah, let's give a little factual background.
Want to do the honors?
Sure. You know how we can just kind of chime in and say a couple things here and there, you know. Let's see. Let's begin at the beginning, which is how about we start with his birth? He was born on December 22nd, 1960 in Park Slope, Brooklyn,
okay,
in like a middle-class residential area.
Brooklyn born?
Yeah, Brooklyn born.
Yeah.
So and he overdosed and he died on August 12th. All right,
that's like the beginning and jump way to the end.
Hey, well, you know what? We're going to talk about the middle, but I'm just giving the facts.
Sure.
You know, so Jean-Michel Basquiat, born December 22nd, 1960, Park Slope, Brooklyn, middle class neighborhood. And he died from an overdose on August 12th. 1988, and he was only age 27.
27.
Yeah, I think it's good to talk about the beginning and the end instantly because it leaves a mystery.
Exactly.
Like,
what happened in between?
What happened in between? He only died at 27. He was a famous artist. Like, what's the story?
Yeah.
So?
And, yeah, actually, I didn't know about Basquiat at all. Being an artist and going through art school, never heard of him.
Really?
Never saw him in a art history book until I saw the movie Basquiat, which is my introduction to Jean-Michel.
Yeah. Well, you know why? Why do you think you never saw him in an art history book or learned about him in school?
It's like only recently where he's been kind of recognized as a genius of that era, the pop art movement, circa Andy Warhol.
Yeah. It's a tough one, in my opinion, because, you know, on one hand, you know, he's credited as being the first African-American artist to reach the level of international art star.
Right.
And considered to be significant as a painter as a whole.
Right.
And there are a lot of black painters and there are a lot of different types of painters, but typically you'll have certain, you know, group painters, you know, painting just and speaking just to their audience.
Right.
Say a black painter dealing with black issues and his paintings are for the black community. Jean-Michel's paintings were for an international, for everybody, but it definitely related to his situation as being, you know, mixed African-American descent in the United States, but it wasn't just focused on the African-American audience.
Right.
So on that end, you know, he was the first to break through that glass ceiling, so to speak.
It's probably due in part to how, to the time that he happened to become a painter. It was during the you know, the dawn of the hip hop era, graffiti, especially during the era where graffiti artists were being recognized by galleries, you know, as being valid. Or I don't know. You had some thoughts about that, like fine art versus was it underground art? What'd you call it?
Well, lowbrow.
Lowbrow.
Yeah,
art.
They call it lowbrow and highbrow art. Yeah, the line's blurred. I guess to explain that, lowbrow art is considered art. At one time, it was graffiti art, kind of like commercial art, kind of art for fun. Almost like a lot of things that you see currently like in Juxtapose magazine.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that line has been blurred between fine art and lowbrow art on that sense. But I think, you know, well, when Basquiat, you know, was writing graffiti, he was writing same-o, you know, and he wasn't just writing, you know, tags or just tagging same-o. He was actually making, you know, he had phrases, political statements, social statements. Almost, he was writing his poetry on the walls. So he was very much like a romantic poet in a sense, but he was just using the wall as his canvas. And so that's one of the reasons why, you know, some people say that he wasn't a graffiti artist.
Right.
And when people try to label him as a graffiti artist, it doesn't actually fit.
Yeah, because this is just my impression of graffiti. Graffiti is very much akin to, like, if I had to, like, map it to a music, would be very kind of hip-hop, very early, you know, like, 80s, like, braggadocio. Like, it's about the biggest and boldest tags. And if you had to kind of put his artwork in that same category, it doesn't really fit. It was really quiet. It was like, you know, simple lines of text, simple poems. Quite the opposite of like this kind of like real bold, sharp graffiti that was happening at the time.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, well, you know, and I mean, he was, you know, we say definitely, you know, born in the Brooklyn area, so he was around, and he was from mixed parents too. His mother was Puerto Rican, and his father was Haitian. Mm-hmm. You know, so he had a multicultural background, exposed to a lot of different things. So, you know, it makes sense. He hung out with like the Taggers and the Breakers and that whole new, like the whole movement that was taking place in New York at that time, like right. The whole downtown scene, you know, of the early 80s. So, but I think, you know, what I've come across is one of the like underlying controversial things with Basquiat is his importance in our right. world, his relevance. I think on one hand, he's very important and relevant for the fact that he did break that glass ceiling. He was the right. first. He's discredited by many like officials in the art world, if you even want to call these people officials. And what I say by that, to describe that, I mean, you know, people in positions of power to dictate who is and who isn't, which would be the gatekeepers, you know, as far as, you know, publishers and people who deal with museums and, you know, of that sort. But on one end, his work is quite valid. Recently, he had a painting that was sold for, I think it was like around $15 million. Mm-hmm. One of his works from the drummer from Metallica.
Lars Ulrich?
Yep, actually yeah. sold it recently. So, hey, $15 million, you know, for Basquiat piece shows you that his work is relevant, it's in demand, and it's considered. You know, it's definitely a part of the core of art world, and he's pulling numbers like any of the biggest names in the business, you know, in the art world. So that alone is a huge accomplishment. But again, one of the things people try to discredit him for is because he, what they consider him like a star that trickled out before he was able right. to reach true brilliance. He died at 27.
Yeah. But, you know, I guess there's always room for that sort of character, like the James Dean, like the brilliant young artist that dies early. Like, you know, we have Heath Ledger now, and, you know, it's just, we have this fascination with this kind of tortured artist, young artist that kind of like burns his can, you know, burns out before his time, because I think probably because we get disappointed by the end when you see some of the like James Brown, you know, and mugshots and stuff like that. You kind of like, you know, maybe we can just stop him early in their heyday. So I think we, especially as Americans, we got that obsession. I think his popularity now is kind of grown because he's kind of fitting the times. Like the times are starting to catch up with his kind of style, that emo sort of music. That kind of like stripped down hip hop, his kind of demeanor, kind of swagger, kind of real lean back. You know, it's, I can see kids nowadays kind of being attracted to this figure. And I, just being a layman, I haven't seen any other, like since like the Warhol era, like any like rock star artist. I mean, we have Shepard Fairey, which is probably the closest we have.
He's not a rock star artist though.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He's definitely, you know, not even to take the show off, but he, you know, should be credited for starting a cultural, you know, I don't even want to call it a cultural movement, but, you know, he planted something interesting with the whole Obey campaign, you know. Yeah. Actually, speaking of that, just as we always take our side notes, I was riding on 95, well, Delaware Avenue in Philadelphia, and I saw a sticker on a pole, mm-hmm. and the sticker said, "Oh boy," and it was a spin on the Obey
campaign.
So it was funny because the Obey campaign went full circle.
The campaign,
yeah,
right. Yeah.
And so I mean, it's, you know, it's officially done. You know,
yeah,
it wrapped it up, and it's one of those things. You know, if we'll remember it next year.
Yeah.
Or 5 years from now, you know, it's kind of when things stand the test of time. But it was just interesting to see that. So, you know, as a creator, I mean, you couldn't ask for anything more. Yeah. You know, it ran its full course.
Yeah, I like to do a separate show on Shepard Fairey.
Well, all right, we'll do a separate show on that. Right. So, you know, but this is Jean-Michel time.
Jean-Michel,
you know, more
time.
Facts about Jean-Michel.
How about some resources where people can go view his artwork or ways to view his artwork?
Oh, like, I mean, this is just Google him, like yeah. anything. You know,
you
mean?
Know, I would say just that, but I'm looking at this, I mean, like this beautiful, beautiful book. Can I do a
sure.
quick plug for the Jean-Michel Basquiat Show? And I think it's published by Chrysler. Is it like a Chrysler sponsors this magazine? Or this, excuse me, this book?
Yeah, it looks like it.
And it's some beautiful shots in here that, you know, like it's, Google and internet is cool, but like actually having like some like a good illustrated book to see his work, kind of see him in situations, I think is essential.
True, true. You know what? An interesting fact that I found out about Jean-Michel and the fact, like, even surrounding his death, did you know that before he died, he had tickets? He was planning to go to Africa.
Really?
Yeah, move to Africa.
About to hit a Dave Chappelle.
Yeah, he was planning to move to Africa, and he OD'd 6 days. He already had the tickets purchased.
Man.
Yeah, he already had the tickets purchased. He was going to Abidjan. Did I pronounce that correct? Abidjan.
Google it.
Yeah. yeah, so on August 18th was his flight, and he died on August 12th.
Man, it's fucked up.
You know?
Like, we just held on for a little bit, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, so I mean, what do you think about that whole story? I mean, again,
it's kind of unhealthy. The whole, it's romantic. The whole artist dying of drugs before his genius, but that's kind of, that's kind of whack.
Well, even with his death, some people blame it on the New York art scene putting too much pressure on him, being, you know, so young and being the first African American artist to break that glass ceiling, that he was constantly tested and pressured from, you know, from critics, from writers. They called him like the pickaninny, you know, in the movie of the art world. And there was like all of these racial slurs and jokes and jabs that he had to deal with. And he was the first one he had to deal with constantly. Do you think that could have drove him to even do more drugs? Some people do. They blame the New York art scene for...
I mean, at the end of the day, he's a grown-ass man, you know? But I think, yeah, those are all stressors, things that kind of help, you know, probably contribute to the fact that he... But he probably already had, you know, had issues beforehand.
Yeah, you know? So you wouldn't blame the New York art world?
I just wouldn't, you know, I'm kind of type of dude, like, you know, it's at the end of the day, he's the one that shot up, you know?
Yeah.
And, I just thinking, like, just kind of put that attitude back in. You know, I can see now, like, kid coming up, a painter, kind of taking that swagger and thinking that's part of the cool of taking drugs and dying before your time. And it's kind of like, no, that's not really healthy. Like, maybe you can just kind of be cool. Maybe you can hold back on the drugs and stuff like that. You know, if you have problems beforehand that kind of necessitate that, you know, so be it. But not to kind of like adopt it as a lifestyle. And I think that's the thing that's glamorized with these kind of James Dean characters like Basquiat.
So you think that his whole, you know, like the drugs and overdosing is part of, you think is being glamorized, would you say, like,
yeah,
in your opinion?
I think that's when people mostly talk, you know, any discussions I hear about Basquiat is usually about his, it's almost like a promise of something that didn't happen, that people are kind of like going through the archives and discovering finally now.
Yeah, yeah.
But this young artist, he died so young. He was only 27, you know.
And
he died. I mean, it's definitely like his stuff of, you know, movies are made out of, you know, it's legends are made out of. So
yeah,
it's a lot more exciting than him, you know, living to a ripe old age of 72.
True, true. And still painting. I mean, he would still be very young.
Yeah.
In his 50s.
Yeah.
Now, you know, mid-50s or so. But, yeah, man, I think it's all, you know, interesting. I hear all different types of things. You know, I'm glad that he, you know, existed and did what he did.
Yeah.
It seems like, you know, to me it felt like, you know, it seems like he just kind of like got things started. And I guess, you know, because he wasn't white, because he's African-American descent, you know, he carried all of this, you know, supposed cultural weight on his shoulders, as society likes to do, and as media, you know, as if, you know, like all of a sudden you represent all black people now, Basquiat, because your skin's black. I mean, I definitely didn't, you know, see that he felt he did that in his work.
Do you know what, you know, the thing though? What's his Mona Lisa? Like, what's his artwork that stands out that people remember? I think that's the only thing he doesn't have.
I would agree. His whole art or package was more about his whole life,
right,
and not the work itself,
right,
or one particular piece. There are certain particular pieces that you know, I would say knowledgeable collectors and dealers know of and fans, but you know, it's one of those things. And even because of that, people again go back and say, well, you know, people try to not promote him or wipe him off of the art world scene because, you know, he's black or he didn't achieve his pinnacle of success or whatever that is. But
you know,
it's
like even back to what I was talking. I'm sorry.
Even
that kind of brings to the point of like even going back and looking at his work, and I think it's amazing. Like, you know, I think his work really is like, you know, his style. Like, this is all very, look at this layout. We're looking at, we can't share this over the radio, but pick up a book, Google him, and actually just look at his work. Because I think, you know, no one ever talks about, like, just his individual paintings.
But I think there's people who are going to look at his work and say, you know what, this looks like scribbles of a second grader. It looks like a kid did this. It looks like crap. I can do this. My daughter, 2 years old, she can do this.
You know, Jackson Pollock.
But still, what would you say to that person who, you know, how would you explain it?
I would just say it's not, you know, it's, you, if you look, I'm looking at this painting right now, titled, Untitled. but it makes sense to me. It's how I think.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm just laying down my raw thoughts and how you kind of like make things in pictograms and symbols that have a very specific and, immediate meaning at the time, and then just laying them down like you laying them down in your sketchbook. So this represents a thought. It doesn't look like it's just like scribble to me.
Would you consider Basquiat a, you know, an artist with like just based on technical ability to be able to draw? Or would you rate his, you know, because you yourself are an artist and an illustrator. Where would you rate him?
You know, I always wonder if he can really draw, you know, like if he can actually draw. And I'm just looking at even like the scribbles that he has here, the pattern, the design, the color, like how everything's laid out, the structure of it. Like he had, if anything, like dope design skills. I think at the base of that, you can be, you know, I think his point wasn't to draw like the Mona Lisa, but to kind of like have, put out his own artistic statement. And this was like the most immediate means for him to do so.
Yeah.
But I was never really a fan of like photorealistic art or overly technical, like beautiful art. I was never really interested in that.
Yeah.
So.
All right, cool.
Yeah, I think his artwork is beautiful.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, and to understand his work in the context of, you know, in any period of work or any type of work, it's very important to understand when it came out and what it meant.
Right.
You know, during that time, you know, you had work of like, you know, Warhol, you had Lichtenstein, you had these guys that were doing like these really graphic, clean pop art.
Right.
And that was the, you know, the main style. Those kind of images were like the paragon of art world, elitism for that fact. And so with all that going on, here you have this, you know, like this neo-expressionist, you know, like making these like kind of violent scratches and intense colors and crossing out words. And just again, you know, like I said, just using an expressionist style to say what he was thinking, you know, on psychological levels. And compared to what was going on, it was, you know, it was bold, it was daring, it stood out. It was in kind of complete opposite direction of what was like the status quo at that time.
Right.
And so because of that, and, you know, Jean-Michel himself, when you just look at a picture of him, it was powerful, and it stood out and it left a dent, you know, and that's one of the key things to understand, you know, his work at that time. You know, in that time period. I mean, just looking at his work, he was inspired by artists like, you know, Cy Twombly, you know, and he's even mentioned that. You can see that a lot of the etchings and the words that he has, that he writes, you know, and definitely Picasso.
Yeah, you can definitely see that.
You can see Picasso in there, yeah. So, you know, and actually, when I was in Brooklyn, this was like a couple of years ago, it was a retrospective on his work, and the first thing that came to my mind was like, I can't believe he did all of this. You know, I mean, he has a very quick style that he could produce that much work.
Right.
But he actually did produce a lot of work. And when you're walking around, you know, you just see work like everywhere, all types of work everywhere. And that was pretty cool to see.
Right. So, do we want to talk about the movie?
I think, yeah. Well, we talked about his life a little bit about the artwork. Yeah, let's talk about the movie Basquiat in comparison to, you know, movie in general, and then in comparison to his real life.
Right. Yeah, because that's a good lead in.
Yeah.
Because Basquiat, again, it's the first time I've ever heard of him, and so when you recommended the movie to me, went out and I rented it right away, and like fell in love with it. Watched it probably like a million times over and over again. And I think the movie kind of painted a very, like, again, like that very romantic portrait. Like, again, like you can name any sort of character that fits in that mold. Kurt Cobain, you know, like, artist burns out really fast. We fall in love with him, you know, kind of like timeless artist. You always remember him in his prime, sort of deal. The movie itself was starred Jeffrey Wright in the role of Basquiat. It starred David Bowie as Andy Warhol. Who else we have in there? We have Gary Oldman. And he played like an amalgam of like a few different characters.
Yeah, I don't know who he was supposed to be specifically. Right. But well, it was directed Julie Schnabel. And screenplay written by Michael Holman.
Michael Holman.
Yeah. He's actually a former band member with Basquiat and his band Gray. So I mean, we can even get into that. So yeah, what about the film? What was your impression, like your first time seeing it?
Again, it was just, in of itself, it was just like a beautiful, beautiful film. And I was just fascinated about finding out about like this artist that existed at this time that I've never heard of before. Like, where was this person? It's almost like they made him up and inserted him in that time, because I've never heard of him at all. And again, I went to art school, and no one ever brought him up at all. So it was kind of like almost like a discovery, and kind of fell in love with the movie. I think afterwards, as I really started to kind of pay attention to his artwork and started to view Basquiat apart from the movie, it started to give me a better idea who he was as an artist.
True. I think the first time you see the movie, well, any movie, the first time you see the movie, that is, you know, the impression that you have of him. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until later, until I started, like you said, doing some research, seeing some old video clips of him, seeing his work, to like learning the true picture. And that's mm-hmm. one of the things that they say, you know, the movie catches a lot of flack in many circles, because they, you know, feel that the movie kind of robbed Basquiat of his relevance, right, and made him to be this romantic, drugged out artist who was always, you know, high and just kind of, you know, this whole wild story, which is great for a movie and as far as entertainment is concerned, but it's important to dig into the facts, you know, and not rely on a movie to define the individual. So I think, you know, socially, as he becomes more, you know, known to the general public, that there will have to be some responsibilities taken from certain individuals. If it's more movies, if it's more documentaries, but more information and film about Jean-Michel Basquiat to paint a more clear picture.
Right.
Of him and his life.
Yeah, because the movie made him seem like he was like always in spaceland.
Always.
And like there was no thought really behind what he was doing, and everything was almost happening by, you know, accident, like he's like by luck.
True. And it's like you couldn't leave him alone or he'd OD.
Exactly.
You know?
Right. Like he was like a child.
Yeah.
And again, artistic license, they extracted that from him, like his character, I think right now, I think we're kind of going through a period. I'm starting to see him appear more and more in popular culture, more retrospectives. Like a new generation is catching on to the movie, and even though it's kind of a work of fiction, it is at least giving them access to Basquiat.
Yeah.
People's first access to Basquiat.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I know personally we're talking about his work. I mean, I consider, you know, the whole package to be his artwork, you know.
His life.
I think, personally, that the art itself without the story is something completely different.
Right.
I think it's, you know, but you can't separate them. That is the art.
Right.
It all goes together. And that's like saying, like, a soup can just by itself is just a soup can, you know. But when you take, you know, Warhol again and spin it, it's the whole story. And making a connection, Warhol and Jean-Michel were very good friends, you know, very close. And people even say that, you know, Warhol's death was one of the, you know, things, as well as breaking up with his girlfriend at the time, that kind of like really pushed him over the edge.
Yeah.
You know, went into serious bouts of depression.
And I didn't mean in the beginning to be like, well, he's stupid. But just the idea of, you know, like, it's making sure we kind of, like, go back to the whole idea of, like, personal kind of responsibility as it comes to, like, future generations of artists, you know? Like, it's...
True.
You
have people.
People in general.
Yeah.
Yeah, just you have control over your situation, you know?
Yeah, yeah, people in general. Yeah, definitely in any situation, not saying, oh, this person made me do it, or they made me do it, or it was because of this or that, you know?
Yeah.
But again, artists are always positioned to be these frail...
Destined beings, sad creatures that kind of float around in artwork.
Well, it's me. Yeah, pretty much.
I'm so tortured by my work. I'm gonna slip my wrist. You know, like, please.
Yeah, but I think what's interesting about the Warhol Basquiat connection is, you know, they got together and it was, you know, Warhol at that time had his run early '70s, you know, mid '70s, and in the '80s, you know, Jean-Michel helped to kind of like pretty much jumpstart. It was like a mutually beneficial relationship between those two. Basquiat, because he was, you know, like the wild card and happening right then, and difference of their styles that, you know, Basquiat was helped to bring Warhol and introduce him to that whole kind of hot, hip 80s downtown scene that was going on at the time. And Warhol, you know, helped to validate Basquiat, you know, on that end. And they had some collaborations and they together. When they worked together and did, you know, some of the paintings, and none of the paintings became very popular. You know, they were still interesting and they tried to kind of mash their styles up, you know, and Warhol was definitely about the marketing. So, I mean, it was a great, you know, marketing for Warhol and Basquiat to get together and do a show.
Hey, you know what, too? Something that's kind of occurred to me. Do you think that Basquiat kind of gained the idea of like the mass production of his artwork? Because after a certain number of like works for Warhol, you really don't remember all of his works. Like, he just did a lot of stuff and painted a lot, you know.
He didn't actually even do a lot of
stuff.
Well,
yeah, exactly. He had a production line
going. That's his art.
The factory. Right, it was that.
That was his whole, that's a whole other show. But Jean-Michel.
Yeah, but I think, do you think, because there is so many pieces of Jean-Michel, you see, like, every time you see his work, you see, like, a new painting, then maybe he, you know, that was something he picked up from Warhol, or something he already had beforehand, like that sort of just...
I think he just had a hardcore, serious work ethic, you know, and it's like he, like you know, read interviews and things, he always wanted to be a celebrity, an art celebrity, you know, and I think he planned it, and a lot of it was calculated, even when, like, he would do his tags and write Samo and his poetry on walls. He just wouldn't write it on any wall.
Mm-hmm.
He would write it on a wall across the street from prominent galleries.
Right.
So, and he knew when exhibitions were. So when people would come out and they're hanging out and they look and they see this graffiti, like, he was very strategic about his whole mission and his whole plan. So on that, it was just like brilliance. And like, he just came through and he executed, you know, his plan on that end. Even like, he approached Warhol and Bruno Bischofberger, you know, when they were having lunch.
Yeah.
You know, so he spotted him and he went in and marketed himself.
Yeah, that's the other thing that struck me too, like his entrepreneurship as an artist.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Well, when you're talking about his entrepreneurship as an artist, I mean, it got to a point with his work that you had. He was, you know, he had his main dealers, you know, at that time, like Mary Boone, Larry Gagosian Gallery, and Bruno Bischofberger. And, you know, they, again, in some circles, are credited with, also, again, everybody's credited, the world's credited with the demise of Basquiat, you know. But they're credited, you know, with creating kind of like price wars with his work. Bruno Bischofberger was one, was known to, you know, come in, he'd fly into New York, you know, and he'd have tons of money, and he'd go around buying art, buying it low, selling it high, just making prices really crazy. Mm-hmm. And at that time, in New York, in the art world, like, the prices and things, they were just kind of like ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
It was, the, you know, even like, he had a snip from the movie where, you know, artists could literally, Basquiat at the time, write his name on a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see that in the museum.
Currency.
Yeah, or a gallery next week or the next day. So it was just bananas. Mm-hmm. You know, people just writing big fat checks and just like buying everything. So I can't even imagine with that kind of frenzy, you know, going on. But he had these people, you know, that represented his work, and they were making tons of money off of him, and they were packaging them, him, and marketing them the way that worked best for their gallery.
Right.
You know, they were running their business, and he was living a lifestyle where he was a wild card, you know? So with that, I mean, it's, you know, I think the energy around his work matched his work.
Right.
When you look at it, there's chaos in it. You know, there's a lot of energy. There's some thoughts and some ideas, but there's unfinished thoughts and ideas. There's crossed out words. Right. There's layering. There's not any sense of control or direction. It's uninhibited. You know, it's smeared. It's confused. It's all of those things. And I think that's all part of what psychologically he was feeling at that period, which makes the work so dynamic in the context with his life.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was getting at. Like, the painting's almost like immediate thoughts. Like, he's getting these thoughts down, like, as quick as possible without regard to, like, beauty, technical beauty.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Just sharing straight ideas on canvas.
Yeah, and that's the whole, well, everything we just talked about, that is the definition of an expressionist painter. Mm-hmm. That's what they do, you know? It's emotion, it's raw, it's those kind of things. So, and the catch-22 of that is to, you know, I would say, you know, to be an expressionist painter, like Pollock, typically have that kind of turmoil in their head and in their lives as well, which makes them like a valet. And in some way, that's what we want. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it's
that's another thing, these labels in art, you know.
Well, it's a, you know, you gotta explain things and categorize it and package it up so the masses marketing. Can consume it.
Art is business,
you know. Yeah, that's what it's all about, you know, on that end. But, you know, Jean-Michel had different interests. He had his paintings primarily, you know, and he had a band
we
talked about, Gray, and they made like experimental music, a fusion between like jazz and
didn't he do a little film too? Film work he did. He started in Downtown 81.
Yep, Downtown 81, another one of his band members' films, Michael Holman. So I actually had the pleasure of meeting Michael Holman.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, really, really cool cat, you know. I got a chance to listen to some of the music from the band, Gray. Yeah, it was cool. It's like, you know, he was telling me a story that they would just make, you know, abstract sounds. Like, they would, you know, put a microphone up and they would take, like, a fork and drag it, like, on a drum head and run that through effects so, like, you wouldn't know what it was. And they would do all kinds of, like, really experimental, trippy things like that. Like, I would say, you know, that was early, like, acid jazz.
Right.
You know? On that end.
It's funny, like, things kind of repeating themselves now. I think at that time, like, technology had, not to get too far off track, technology had kind of caught up to, like, the populist movement of, like, hip-hop and, like, you know, where people didn't have access to instruments and machines. And maybe that's kind of, like, getting back to Basquiat, like, his kind of quick way of kind of painting was kind of indicative of like the culture at the time, where you didn't really have a whole, like, you didn't have a lot of paint, so you had to use what paint you had, get your ideas down really quickly, you know, you didn't have a whole lot of paint to kind of be sitting there kind of making layers and layers of texture, get your ideas down quick with the cheapest materials.
True and it's one of those things that and it reflected his whole image. Mm-hmm. You know, because he was that, you know, raw, like, artist from the street kind of thing, you know, and that was part of his brand and part of his package. So, like, the found object art was perfect for what he was doing, you know, and it worked in perfectly. But, I mean, I would say, again, if there's anybody, you know, interested in learning more about Jean-Michel Basquiat, definitely check him out.
Yeah, there's plenty of resources online.
Yeah.
Every now and again, you'll find a some sort of exhibition close by, if not in Philadelphia, New York, somewhere. I just can't keep an eye out.
Yeah. I don't know about any exhibitions coming up with them, but yeah, definitely keep an eye out on that. You know, do some Google research and those kind
of
things.
And there's plenty of books out now.
Yeah.
Beautiful books.
Yeah, lots of books. And for people, you know, who might see his work and you know, initially go, oh my God, that looks like chicken scratches, that's that, or that looks like crap, or my 2-year-old can do that.
Right.
You know, again, it's the most important thing to think about is the whole story that surrounds the artist.
Right.
And to be able to open your mind outside of just visually looking at something like, okay, that doesn't look like an apple, so I don't get it.
Right.
And think about, you know, psychologically what an apple could feel like, what it could taste like, and kind of, you know, think abstract out of things being so literal. Right. And I think if one can open their mind, then one can freely go and think about Jean-Michel Basquiat and think about his life as a whole, and from that could even appreciate his work a bit more.
Yeah. I had a history teacher that gave me some good advice one time, and not even advice, just kind of a good way to look at art. She said history kind of gave you the facts and figures, and art gave you the heart and feeling. of a particular time. So you're little time machines. So also think about art in terms of the time it was done and what it was saying at the time.
Mm. I can agree with that one. Mm. Cool. You know what? Since I guess, you know, we talked about Jean-Michel a bit, you know, covered his work, talked about the life, talked about the drugs, you know, we talked about the film and all that kind of stuff a little bit. I wanted to, you know, sometimes we do our whole rhyming and we do our music little spin and tie in, you know, wherever we can fit it in, not force it, but where we can fit it in. And there is a little track that I'd like to play, and it's got some samples from the Basquiat movie. And so that'd be cool to play that for folks.
Paint Pusher.
Cool. All right. So we'll just we'll run that. Let everybody check out Paint Pusher, and we'll catch you next time on Open Neck Show.
Open neck.
Open neck.
You are the news, and I want the scoop. Look. When I speak, no one believes me. When I write it down, people know it's true. There's never been a black painter in art history who's been considered really important, you know that?
Are you a writer or a white writer?
I may be white, but I'm a nigga.
Just a little man, jumbo size crown in my hand. Looking up at pops, learning how to beat that clock. Yo, he's sketchy moms, and I'm amazed by that. Understanding how he did it, you would had me trapped. So I grew, little bit, I had a breakthrough. Yeah, it's true, the way I rhyme, I document the truth. So I keep it real, so my spirit can feel. Staying focused on my attitude, paint the picture so real. Check it, and every time that I rhymed on a record, I had a little show, label rep came to check it. And I guessed it, that this way that I spit it, some wouldn't understand it, and I knew that some would feel it. So I formed a band, Blonde Hair, The Fuzzy Hood. We mixed rock and rap, called the ruckus in the hood. Not many bodies came, not many people knew we existed, but I still expressed myself through this music so artistic. Then I got ready, so ready to invent my style. Spent 10 years on it, 2 wives and 3 childs. You wanna know about sacrifice? Shit, you could never know. Understand what I've been through, and in my tempo, cause I'm a real pusher, pushing art into your life. I'm doing it through this music as I've done it all my life. I'm a paint pusher, pushing art into your life. I'm doing it through this music as I've done it all my life. I'm a paint pusher, pushing art into your life. I'm doing it through this music as I've done it all my life. I'm a paint pusher, pushing art into your life. I'm doing it through this music as I've done it through my life. Yeah, my time cards punched on them North Philly streets. Trips to see my poor ass cousins with dirty feet. So fucked up when we roll up in the bins, cause pops don't give a fuck about his family or his friends. Selfish bastard, cause all I know I learned it from him. Keep a distance from the wife and the children is straight. I need a hug, so I pulled it all into my heart, and I opened up my heart using canvas as the start. Mostly red, lead it from the rug to the bed. My life paints pure on the studio floor, so watch where you step, cause museums want more. And I'm the artiste to secure a prominent position in the definition of a painter. I sculpt a new image of something much greater.